But we're open. Here's to be an informal time when you can get to know our guest speakers more personally. If you have personal questions you want to address to them, where they're at in their spiritual quest, or if you want to react to the lecture this evening, we can go that way. Anyone want to start the round circle? Yes.
Dr. Sittler, could the exhaustion of conventional energy supplies change or alter your presupposition that we will be living in an age of ever-expanding space in which to think? Could the exhaustion of conventional energy supplies reverse that process and begin to narrow the space in which we'll be thinking?
Well, at least the the radical shift in what we may count on as usable energy, that certainly is going to perhaps be the most dramatic event of the next generation's life. It won't change the clock of the cosmos, then. What we do on Earth is not going to have much to do with the exhaustion of the nuclear character, you know, of heavenly bodies. But, you know, had I had a lot of time, I would get into the issue that you potentially raised. What are the resources within Christian theology for a Christian response to the environmental crisis? Now, it's really, that's how I started thinking about all this. I didn't start in metaphysical spaces thinking about this. I got worked up about the environmental crisis way back in the 40s. And then as I kept asking, what in the biblical theology, what in the history of Christian theology is directed to man's relationship to the world as nature? It's out of that kind of question that I began to ask the Christological question. Is there a Christology for the natural world? The moment you ask that question, you can't dismiss the Romans 8, the whole creation groans in travail waiting. A very clear connection, although it remains obscure in the 8th of Romans. Just what did Paul mean by that? The whole creating waiting for the manifestation of the children of God. And that the creation being somehow conjoined with or included in the realm of redemption. These are very puzzling statements in Romans. So that I came via the environmental question to asking, has biblical Christology a language which will include God the creator of heaven and earth, and my responsibility as a creature for God's creation? It's out of that that I ask the other question. So indeed, you know, I could have a whole other lecture tomorrow on a theology for the environmental crisis. And I just might do it, you know, because I think it's terribly important. But it's a sardonic fact that the church, except for some making some new noises about stewardship, hasn't really said anything about it, hasn't been very analytical about it, has not really pressed it as an ethical problem with a particular interest for Christians, and laying upon them a particular duty, nor has the church as institution asked, what might we do in our common procedures in view of this crisis? So I would love to talk about that if we can get time tomorrow.
Do you see points of contact, Dr. Sittler, between the kinds of things you were talking about, or at least they suggested some ideas to me, in terms of parallels or points of contact with theology of Teilhard de Chardin?
Yeah. Most of you know the name he refers to, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, a Jesuit, a member of the Jesuit order, a priest that is, but also a distinguished paleontologist, started writing as early as 1930. Started writing theological, speculative things in theology, which moved in the same, he disturbed by the same things I later became disturbed by, but he was a very eminent paleontologist, and I'm not. But the Catholic Church utterly silenced him. When he made an effort to expand traditional Catholic Christology to the kind of time span that he, as paleontologist, was always dealing with, he was making very unconventional statements and reading the scriptures in a way that did not please the magistrates or the magisterium, so he was forbidden to publish. And only later, after, of all people, Pius XII lifted the ban on him, and he published his explosive book called The Phenomenon of Man, which was published in paperback here by Harper, and was widely used in colleges and universities. And then The Future of Man, and then his last book, The Mystery of Christ, a marvelous book. Well, I had started thinking in these ways, and when I encountered Teilhard, I was an enormous relief to me to know that I wasn't the only crazy guy around. And that the very distinguished Catholic theologian was thinking these thoughts. And it was through his influence, partly, that I went back to Irenaeus. Because in Faith and Order, in the World Council in Faith and Order, I had come into contact with Eastern Orthodoxy. And there I saw something that, as a Western Christian, I really had never encountered. The wonderful imagery in Eastern liturgies on Christ the Cosmocrator, the Lord of the whole universe, in their icons, in their symbolism. So I started scrounging around, and Jerry Pelican helped me. He said, you want to read Irenaeus, second century theologian. I found Teilhard's ideas and things I was thinking already being said very clearly in the second century by Irenaeus, and also in Orthodox theology all the way through the century. You see, to make it most clear, the image of Christ that's most important for us is the crucified one. Now, it is no diminution of the centrality of this to recognize that there are other dimensions to Christ's lordship. And in an Orthodox church, the central figure is commonly not the crucifix, but or even the empty cross, but on the dome of the church always will be the figure of Christ with his arms outstretched over the world, the orb, the Christus Pantocrator, the cosmic ruler. So that this, when I began to work toward what your chairman called a cosmic Christology, it was not anything really new, because it occurs certainly in the Gospel of John. It occurs in the lesson that was read this morning in Ephesians, and most absolutely clearly in Colossians, he is that from whom all things proceed, toward which all things tend, in whom all things hold together. If that's not cosmic, I don't know what is. So that these enormous postulations about the role and realm and meaning of Christ are not strange. They are in the New Testament, though not a major strand there. And it's interestingly, we Lutherans have not paid much attention to them, because at the time of the Reformation, that's not where the problem was. That's not the question people were asking, or the battle Luther was fighting.
You talked about the loss of the sense of the transcendent, and I hear from other circles that the secular is really calling for the church to make some statements about a transcendent, that they are concerned and want that restated for them. Would you say that's valid, or are they just talking?
I don't think that the secular world is calling upon the church for anything. I think it's closer to the truth to say the secular world ignores the church. It is simply uninterested. But not the secular world so much, but I can think of three areas in which new kinds of questions are being asked, which are clearly related to the church's tradition in the realm of philosophy, in the realm of language, contemporary language studies, and in the realm of the arts, where, the arts have never lost what I was calling a sense of the transcendent. There are periods when they move away and carry on purely experimental probings for new ways. You wouldn't find much transcendence in modern painting, but there is also much going on in art that shows its sense. The artist, by definition, is always probing for meanings that are not apparent, for more than meets the eye, for the secret of things, you know. So that the artistic community, it's no secret that for centuries the artistic community and the ecclesiastical community were, if not hand in glove, at least in a close alliance. But that alliance has only really been almost utterly broken in our day. So I don't find the world asking the church to do anything or say anything, but that's nothing new, and that has nothing really to do with what we do or say. But I don't find that an open invitation. If I'm invited to speak at a university, it's not because I'm a theologian, but despite it, mostly. Because of, I see funny relationships between theology and literature, theology and art, and so that I sort of get in by the side door. That's changed in the last 15 years. Paul Tillich, remember, I'm no Paul Tillich, but Tillich was invited qua theologian. But there are no Paul Tillichs around at the moment.
Barth used to be. Barth would be one.
Oh, yeah. But of course, Barth never came over here except once, and then under very strict limits.
You don't think the rumor of angels, then, is alive in the secular world? Is that more Christians asking for, you know, some transcendent evidence? Or?
I think there are rumors of angels all over the place, but interestingly, the church is not the place they're looking to find them. Mm-hmm. No, I'm quite serious about that. I made an exception this evening when I was talking about novels. Some of you may have been reading Saul Bellow from the very beginning of his early Henderson the Rain King and Mr. Zamler's Planet, Herzog, now in this last book, Humboldt's Gift. Bellow, as he gets older and more mature as an artist, is recapturing his Jewish religious inheritance. It comes out in very subtle ways. He is a very, some sense, a Jewish mystic. And it comes out in the most peculiar, modern ways. So that there are rumors of angels, I think, all over the place. But the church is not regarded as the authorized residence of the saints. And for, I think, very understandable reason. The great issues, many of the great issues of our time have not been engaged by the church with any real human force. The racial issue, we sat on our tails while the railroad unions and the labor unions and Marshall Field and the First National Bank all confronted the issue of the color line. And we had to be drawn screaming into a human dealing with the deprived minority. No wonder the church doesn't look for angels within our gates. Now, that's not altogether just, because you look at the civil rights struggle, the church was very prominent. Parts of the church, or not the church, but church people. You know, the many great figures in the civil rights struggle of the 60s were born and bred on the teachings of Jesus, the ethicality of the Synoptic Gospels. Martin Luther King, you know, was not a Buddhist. He was a good old Southern Baptist, brought up under his daddy's preaching. And Ralph Abernathy and William Sloan Coffin at Yale and a number of very prominent people came directly out of their Christian tradition into their sensitivity to that issue and put themselves on the line.
I understand, because I'm off your surgery. I read something and I forget the source, but it seems to me there was an article in our LCA Lutheran some weeks ago, and it seems to me it was a great gathering of eminent people, scientists and the like. How long can our civilization, the United States, last? There is a peak to which everything can go. Egypt, Babylon, Rome. And they gave it 10 years. Now, is that sort of a nihilism that will permeate a lot of the non-people, the non-Christian people?
I didn't see the piece, and I therefore cannot answer your question, but it is not a foolish question, because to look at but one aspect of it, I do not wish to support any particular political program, though I think there's nothing unchristian in that, but the president's energy program, it may not have been the best conceivable program by a human mind, but it was a clear, positive, demanding program. And it's being chewed to pieces. I think if a Republican president come up with a program, it too would have been chewed to pieces. It's not a political matter. It simply means that the American civilization is a civilization of spoiled brats. We are an oil-based civilization, and we cannot get it through our heads that the resources of the earth are finite. If the whole middle of the earth were filled with oil, which it is not, that still is a finite quantum. We really don't believe. All the polls show the common life in America does not believe there is an energy crisis. Now that is the stupidest thing that one could imagine. Now we may argue about the pace of the crisis, the degree of the crisis, but that when something a whole culture is built on is in diminishing supply, ultimately that's a crisis. Whether, you know, a billion tons of oil or less than that. But you remember in Toynbee's famous work, he says, the civilization turns the corner toward decline when new challenges are not met by fresh responses. And we are meeting new challenges, and we seem incapable of fresh responses in many cases. So that raises the question which political scientists or philosophers are asking. Is a democracy capable of making the kind of decisions that a technologically based society is requiring? Can we expect that highly technical, factual problems can be put to the head count of the common life? It's a very grave question. Remember the English The English man who wrote the American Commonwealth, Lord Bryce, said a democracy can work only under optimum conditions. Well, since the founding of this nation, we have had optimum conditions. An enormous resource, unadministered but there, a resolute people on this immense continent, and we have done amazing things with it, and we have therefore developed what's called the American style of life, that resources are endless, that energy won't run out, that we can have a lifestyle to which the whole advertising agency allures us to go on forever. And I don't think it's a debatable problem. It can't. It cannot. I try, and I'm part of it, you know. It's hard for me to get used to this. And I can't teach my children to turn out the lights. They're reasonably smart kids, but they see no connection between complete carelessness about the use of energy and what they know to be the facts of the case.
Dr. Sindler, you mentioned earlier on about the fact that as you study these things, more and more the scriptures become relevant to what we're talking about. But it seems to me that that man just does not just we as Americans don't react, but man from the earliest foundation seemed to, the prophets tried to tell them, hey, change, or this is what's going to happen. And the people saw what was happening and still insisted on doing it. I'm wondering whether we're not dealing with a very basic, sinful nature of man at this point. Man's incorrigible optimism that he has the answers and that somehow things are going to go on like they always have gone on and they're not going to change. And until he's forced to the wall, when the gas runs out and the car comes to a halt on the freeway and the freeways become parking lots, then you'll realize we've got an energy problem.
Well, yes, I think it is clear that people are capable of walking with their eyes wide open, right straight into catastrophe, as long as they got plenty to eat and drink on the way. It's true, that is the ancient story of mankind, and in that sense we are no less sinful than our fathers were, or less stupid. But it's a little different now because we expected that the so-called communications industry and the educational process of which we are so proud would give people the facts and they will respond. We've never had such media for getting the facts out, nor such recalcitrance toward acting appropriate to the facts that we get out. So that the energy crisis, when the people's... I listened the other night to one of these microphones carried among the public, you know, what do you think about? What do you think about? And the headline story was that the Senate has knocked down the president's tax on large automobiles and all that. They were asking people, and these gum-chewing citizens of downtown Chicago, I never thought there was any problem in the first place. You know, she got a vote. And all the other people said, well, one woman said, I like my big car, and they no one could take it away from it. Well, not at the moment. So I really am not too optimistic about, I'm not sure the 10-year notion on survival has much sense to it. But I admit I have a very mordant sense of the American future, but also a strange sense that, you know, we really don't learn very fast, but we do, ultimately, in our own history. And we react with great speed when we do react. So that it may be that our own ingenuousness and the remains of our frontier spirit will enable us to hang in there through the transition period.
Well, following on that, Doctor, I would just want to follow. I think that you were speaking of the change in the racial attitude in our country. I wonder whether that was so much the result of any great new awakening of the people, or again that the people were forced by the press of circumstances to accept that which was there and had to be accepted because for economic necessity, among other things.
I think to account for the change is a very mixed and complex series of forces, influences, allures, remembrances. The religious one, there is a kind of strange ethicality in the American public life. We do have delayed responses to obvious situations, you know, so that people would. Martin Luther's speech at the Washington Monument was heard by many people who wouldn't admit publicly they were touched by it, you know. There were people who remained rigid in their personal attitudes, who nevertheless have lessened their public opposition. So I think the ethical, the religious, was an important component in that. Well, I think the sociologists agree, too, that it was. That people who've been analyzed these things, like Andy Greeley at our university, a very important Catholic sociologist, he believes it was probably crucial. Because there's a lot of unadmitted residual guilt in people. And when the facts are presented to them, they won't admit anything, but they will change. Well, if people change, we'll let the admitting go. I remember in our parish, my parish where I'm a communicant in Chicago is an old Augustana parish. It's been integrated for 30 years, so it was nothing new to us, but we have many more blacks now than we had. We always had some in our church school and in the parish, but we have now about 25% or 30% black. I remember there was an old Swede in there, about 80. All his working life he had been the caretaker, manager of the maintenance man of a big public high school. And it was in a black neighborhood, and those kids had pretty careless habits, and they made his life miserable. He didn't like them. And when they came to our church, he didn't like that either. And he said so. But one day he said to me, when I was interim pastor there for a year, and I preached in such a way as to make quite clear what I thought our duty was in that mixed neighborhood, he came up and said, "Look," he said, "I don't like them. I've never liked these black kids. I don't like them now. But apparently God does, and you'll get no flack from this old Swede." That's all I can expect. That's good. That's enough. In this case, he was an old man, but he wasn't going to say more about it. He didn't understand how God could, but obviously he did. Well, I think there's a lot of unannounced acquiescence or shift or opening of the eyes.
Nick? If I may, I'd like to pursue just for a moment something that you have raised as you have spoken about what has happened in America as it relates to black people in particular, minorities in general. First, I want to say, before I come with my question, the civil rights movement was rooted among black Christians. I think that needs to be said and understood. It came out of the black churches of the South, and eventually there were some who were willing among white America to take their stand, and some of them even paid with their life for that stand. Don't want to belabor that, but I want to come into the present era in America. You don't hear much about black people anymore. We no longer have a civil rights crisis or issue even. But at 11 o'clock, 10 o'clock, whatever hour America worships, I would say there's not much change. But Dr. Settler, what do you say?
Well, I guess statistically that's just plain so. You know, what you say is so by objective headcount. Where there have been changes, the changes have been radical. But in most parishes, there is no change at all. Where there have been changes, the changes have been radical. But in most parishes, there is no change at all. Now, in some, we don't know what would happen if the neighborhood were of different colors. But there are many, many big Lutheran parishes where they'd have to import blacks to get one in. I think you have to look at the parishes where it would be quite natural for blacks to come to this church. The second thing is, I don't think the Lutheran Church will ever be a church into which the blacks come in great numbers. I must be careful about that statement, because we have a number of blacks come to our parish, but they're upper-class blacks. They're people who want to make like white people. They want more formality in worship. They want order. They order their lives. They're good, responsible, careful workmen. They want a worship life which has a kind of orderliness, linguistic decorum that they want in everything else in their life. They want their children in a good church school. So they're there not because they're black, but that's the kind of a service they want. There are few, you see, the black church was primarily a Baptist Methodist church in this country, when it was part of an organized national group at all. And their ways are not the same. Now, there are a number of black people in our parish who are there and have said why they're there. They like the music, they like the service, they like... As one old Mrs. Collins said to me, if I want something, I know where to go. She's had something now. She wants something else. So I don't know how really to answer your question, except I don't think in the sight of God it's too important whether they're Lutherans or not. I don't think it's important at all, in fact.
Don't want to belabor, but I want to zero in on the concern that I raised. The question doesn't deal so much with what's happening with black people, but what has happened to white Christian America. See, that's where the problem is, as to why the 11 o'clock hour is still the most segregated hour in America. Not because black people don't live close enough. That's the old reason they used to use. Can't say that anymore. Because in the major cities of America, the black population is increasing. And after all, you have to remember where Lutheranism began. It began in the cities along the Eastern Seaboard there.
and in the Midwest, in cities.
And it's now moved to the suburbs, Lars.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to get at. That, you know, if you look at the situation, it's not a problem of black people. Never has been. Still where it always was. And I don't want to go no further on that, though. But that, I just want to highlight that.
Well, that raises, of course, the whole problem of the church in the city. In fact, the city itself as a residential place. Some cities have virtually ceased to be residential places. A city like Des Moines, Iowa. Downtown Des Moines is deserted after 7 o'clock. Very few people live in the central city, in our big city. New York, yes, they live all over New York. But in Chicago, Chicago's loop is solid black from 7 p.m. on. The only movies operating are black violent movies. All the restaurants have lunch only. Virtually all the restaurants are closed. All that's left are quick food snack shops. The whole thing's been McDonaldized. So that, the cities, that's a huge problem, what's happening demographically with our cities, what this means for the churches. But of course our churches fled the city when the people who supported them fled the city, before the cities became really difficult places. And yet that's not the whole story either. There are fascinating things happening. Hyde Park, where I live, which is on the edge of the inner circle of the city, you cannot buy or rent an apartment or house in Hyde Park this fall. And you fast forward, why? And the real estate people say, because older people who one generation ago moved out to Flossmoor or someplace, their kids are gone, and the suburb, the dullness of the suburb is no longer tolerable. Now that the kids are gone, so they move back in and there's something going on. So that there's been a reverse, and this is true in New York. But there must be people who are here who know much more about this than I do.
Dick?
Just commenting on that, I serve a church in a downtown area. And I think one of the things our people have become very much aware of is the fact that it's really important for us to be involved in coalitions with other people. There was a strong move on the part of the school board to close the downtown high school. And we mobilized quite a lot of people, and they're going to build a new $22 million high school downtown, with the point being of keeping the people downtown and keeping the heart of the city alive. And I think, I really think it's important that the church not play solos, that we be involved with the City Planning Commission and the school board and the Chamber of Commerce and the downtown retail merchants and all of these other people, because these are all involved in those demographics, I think, that you're talking about.
Yes, there are some, you know, Bill Lesher, who's president of Pacific Lutheran Seminary. Bill had a 7 or 8 year ministry at Logan Square in Chicago. And Bill gave leadership via his position at the church to really the renovation of that whole area. And it'd be interesting to have him sometime talk about that, because he knows what he's talking about. Now that does, if, you know, our Lutheran ethos has often been that if you cannot share the entire formula of concord with your neighbor, you can't have anything to do with him as regards social problems. And I'm afraid that often is maintained, not maintained because we love the formula of concord so much, and because it gives us a devout reason for non-engagement at all.
Well, in your estimation then, what would you say would be our primary concern today in face of all of these complexing problems? From your point of view, what would be the central thrust that we as Christians should, is it transcendence, or is it transcendence brings it up in the outside of our ability to speak, outside of our ability to relate?
no, transcendence gives you a central core from which every issue becomes related to the will and the power of God. Just the opposite. My concern with recycling and trash and the energy conservation is due to the fact that I really believe this is my father's world. You know, it doesn't belong to General Motors or the U.S. Steel Corporation or Commonwealth Edison. My immanental involvements are rooted in my transcendental faith. And that's the ancient Catholic tradition in which we stand as Lutherans, that you have to have a fulcrum outside of the secular in order really to get into the secular with force. Now, I know that is true by my experience, by deep involvement in the environmental crisis. I'm the mayor of Chicago, the late distinguished mayor, Mr. Daley, and he was a remarkable guy. I was appointed to the Committee of 100. Now, he doesn't know me, but someone recommended me as they wanted a clergyman, and I'd made noises about Lake Michigan, so I got on the committee. And I found in service on that big citizens committee that when I talked that my concern for Lake Michigan and for planning for the city of Chicago came out of a clearly theological concern for dealing with God's world as his and for his creatures, these people might not share all my theological presuppositions, but no one said that's crazy, or you have no right to make that point. The only ones who thought I should not be involved in that were some of my fellow Lutherans. He said, "You're an ordained Lutheran pastor. What are you doing fooling around with Lake Michigan and the smoke from the U.S. steel stacks in South Chicago?"
Okay, you just answered my question I asked a long time ago. Thank you. Because that's what I heard him saying, that they want us as God's people in that arena.
I thought, Dr. Sipper, in respect to the conversation between our dear brother from St. Mark's, having been in my same old pot stand for 23 years, I learned a lot about Seattle, and I love the town. But I found out a lot of things about that city. Most of the people don't dare to get acquainted with anyone. What they don't know, they're afraid of. I've seen that in many prisons. I've seen it with our alcoholics group. I've seen it in our school system. I've seen it in our church. And when you say the 11 o'clock hour segregation, I heard what you were saying. I know Dr. Sidler did too. And I thought his analysis of, there's a lot of Lutheran churches that I wouldn't want to go to on a Sunday morning because there's no stomping and bumping, you know. But there's something to be said about what you don't know you're afraid of. I think we've made some great strides in this whole area. We haven't got it wet yet, but we're doing it.
Well, it's true that the urban situation is a very lonely one. And it's one that does induce fears that keep people from reacting with normal human openness to another human being, because too many human people get beat up, you know, by the unknown. So I can see why people in the city are frightened, why they curb inward upon themselves, they lock themselves in their hot little apartments. I can understand the motivation for all this, and I really don't know what the answer is. I'm not sure that church-sponsored square dancing every Thursday night really is a very large answer to that question, though it might help. I really don't know. There are many of you who are on the front of this problem know better than I. What the church can do to abate and to break through the barriers of loneliness and fear in the city. And then, of course, our culture is becoming pretty much privatized. I know, since I cannot read any longer and have to have readers, that I've curved inward upon myself as I never had before either, not out of fear, but because through public television, I can get drama, music, literature, a lot of scientific programs, a lot of things I like. But I do that all by myself. You know, I don't have to be in a community of any kind to go to school or share with other people. So that the television is an enormous isolator. Families don't talk anymore after 7:30 at night.
Dr. Sittler?
No.
I'd like you to comment on pursuing that idea of community further, as to the relationship that's been talked here about the cities and urban and suburban. What, you know, the destruction of our life in our big cities, where one can get lost. Is this not a destruction of community also? And is this not also true that our churches can be so large that they're like the cities? The community within the church is destroyed. And that's the basis of our Christian life together.
Yes. I've never belonged to a big church. But I get in them once in a while. No, I don't know the answer to this problem. From the standpoint of the practical pastor on the front, I don't know if I'd be man enough to be a pastor anymore, let alone have energy enough. I don't know what the answer to those problems is, but I'm glad you raised them. Now, our little church has 250 communicants, and it's still a community. So I really am not equipped to answer your question.
I think one experience that I had in the city made kind of reversed that. After growing up in a small town in Washington and going to seminary in Chicago, I learned that through things like a whistle stop program, which was a security program, that I felt very safe and part of the community in the city. And once I accepted the call to Portland and moved out here, and my husband and I live in a parsonage, we didn't feel safe at all anymore. It was like the community had disappeared, and there was no community. And it wasn't just because we were a seminary. There are whistle stop programs that are not connected with, you know, any one specific group. They're just organized in neighborhoods. So for me, I felt more of a community in my years in the city.
Well, that's very interesting, Mike. I have two kids who live in New York, in the middle of the city, and they have very rich community there. Mm-hmm. It's not personal contiguity, but the crossing of interests. And the city, I wouldn't want to live any other place. I have a community that's not just my church or the university or the Lutheran School of Theology, but I've lived in Hyde Park now for 30 years, and I'm not about to retire in the eternal sunshine of Sun City, Arizona, either. I want that community to remain, want me to remain a part of it. So the reality of community is not a demographical datum, that's what we're saying. It is other factors are just as important, as big or little, urban, country. No, I think that's a much more complicated problem than city and small town. Small town can be a very repressive, narrowing, nasty kind of a place too, as I found out.
The community has to be the coming together of interests or the people. Something that we've experienced here at Holden.
But then I think it has a lot to do with how one defines community. I find particularly my children defining community as being a common interest, intent, motive, lifestyle among persons. But I define community in a way they do not. I have a community with the dead. You know, I'm always, I go down the street, see something and think of what Shakespeare or Milton or John Keats or somebody said about it. The whole past that I know is alive for me, so that I have a community in time that transcends my own generation. Now my children don't care about history. They really believe when nothing important happened before they did, I think. And, so that I find my old-fashioned liberal arts education, whereby I had to learn some history and some literature, stands me in pretty good stead, so that the past is still alive in the monuments, in its creations, in the personages, in a way that community is not the chronological datum any more than it's a demographical datum. It's a very complex word, but you seldom hear a sociologist talk about it that way.
Related to that, how would you define loneliness?
I would define... You know, I've never been lonely. I'm not a very good candidate for describing that. I am alone a great deal. But I've never been in the sense that I hear people come to me as pastor and talk about loneliness. I've never had acute, despairing, distressing loneliness. Because I think it, my love of books, and like old Bill Bugey, I can walk down the street and rejoice on every lousy piece of architecture in the street.
Yeah.
it reminds me of other things, and times and places and people, so I would hesitate to try to toss off a definition of this, except existential loneliness, the kind that in which you know that just as you were born, so too of some disease and accident we will all die. And as Luther said, a man, just as a man must do his own dying, so he must do his own believing, we die alone, fundamentally. Fundamentally, I think my sense of the aloneness of the individual, ultimately, came to me so early in life that to be alone never seemed to me to be a strange situation. Now my children can't stand being alone very long. They just can't stand it. And I like it. I don't know how you count for that. I don't think it's this personal disposition. I think it's a matter of education. And contemporary education, I think, is so devoid of historical depth and dimension that it's easier to be lonely now than it was when I was doing it.
You've mentioned your children.
I'd like to hear some teacher talk about that. There must be some high school, college teachers around here.
He's still a young person.
Dr. Sibley, you've mentioned your children several times, and which, you know, we enjoy hearing. And I think that in relation to these matters, as a mother with very young children, I think that sometimes my greatest doubt and fear can come when I look upon them and think of some of the things that are perhaps going to come in their lifetime, and thinking of my grandmother who's 90, and like you say, I think of all the things that have happened in her lifetime. Sometimes I can become so fearful for these little children that are a year and 3 years old. I just wonder what, you know, if you have these kinds of fears for your children and how you dealt with them.
Yeah, I don't think fear, I'm not sure of that. I sometimes am sorry for the thinness of their education. Now they would resent this statement, but happily they're not here. I mean, I rejoice in so many things I had the opportunity to read and love and remember that they don't know anything about. Now, of course, they may know. They know a lot of things I don't know anything about, I'm sure. but I can't help but feel sorry for them in some ways. My daughter once saw me, you know, sitting in there reading and reading. She said, "Don't you ever get tired of that old stuff, you know?" And I said, "Well, no, not really." And she was shaking her head in complete incomprehension. And I said, "There is an interesting fact. I'm never bored, and you are regularly bored. Why is that?" Well, then she did shake her head. Even deeper puzzle. "Oh, what am I going to do now, you know? So-and-so's gone. Now what am I going to do?" When she was a little girl, and I never had any problem with that. But I'm sure I'm being unfair to them. I'm only partially reporting. If they would give their own report, you'd get a different story.
About one more question.
Isn't the problem that the youth are facing today nothing more than a reflection of the adult world? And this aloneness that they have, there is no purposeful goal that they are looking for. For the adults, for example, you know, security. What is it? You know, we're a recreational orientated world, and we're going for a 30-hour week. And what do we do? Instead of recreating, we get another job. And so is the problem that the youth are facing, is it just their problem or is it our problem?
Well, of course, it's not only our problem, but I think we help create it. The adult models our children have around them are not all that good. Their fathers and mothers are often status-seeking, higher income-seeking, wearing themselves out for ends which are febrile and transient, really not noble ends. So that the kids have grown up, they want to make it. What they mean by making it, you know very well what that means. There's certain things you have to have as symbols that you have made it. And now my generation taught them, that's the good life. So we have brought them up that way. They didn't, my children didn't invent the Wall Street Journal and its values, and Forbes magazine, and the TV ratings, and the Miss America pageant, and paying $200,000 a year to Catfish Hunter. You know, they didn't invent that scale of value. We did, and our fathers, so that can't push it on them, all of it. And this kind of thing has very little to do with education. That's what's very humiliating for a professor to admit. Has very little to do with education. I find the PhD, MA, technical director sector of the community can be just as stupid, have as cockeyed a set of values as the people who run the buses and the trucks and clean up the garbage. It's very distressing to see how little impact education has on value structure. I have a charming story from George Lindbeck, many of you know. George Lindbeck, who teaches at Yale, told me that one day the president of Yale University, Kingman Brewster, who's now ambassador to England, came in to congratulate the Yale Divinity faculty upon the excellence of the colleges from which its students were coming. Harvard, Yale colleges, Princeton, Amherst, Williams, the Ivy League colleges up and down the road, you know, and that's great. And George says, one of the more raucous members of the faculty said, "Mr. President, that's a lot of crap." And the president, astounded, I said, "I don't understand what you mean." He said, Well, let's just go around the faculty here. This was years ago. So let's go around faculty and see where your faculty came from. What's his name? Who just went down to Virginia. Forgive me. He said, I graduated at South Dakota Agricultural College. George Lindbeck, Gustavus Adolphus College. Jerry Pelican, Valparaiso, or some, or Luther Academy at Milwaukee, wasn't it? He went around the fact, not a one of them came from a major league. Richard Niebuhr, Elmhurst College. Reinhold Niebuhr, a little college called Wayne University, a Detroit college then in Detroit, Wayne University. Not a single one of them came from the colleges he was congratulating them about. And they were the Yale University faculty. So a sort of symbol of, and I found with my graduate students, they say, aha, this lad came from Amherst. I get a kid from East Burlap Normal, who'll be just as good.